Welcome to the Sanity Podcast. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week, my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, and I speak to the people that you want to hear from.
This week, we're joined by Tiffany Justice, who was the co-founder of the very popular Moms for Liberty movement, and she is now leading the Parental Rights Initiative at the Heritage Foundation, and we're really happy to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's such an important moment for parental rights and for parents and family in general in America.
Yeah.
And welcome.
So the first thing I think to do is to sort of talk about what parental rights actually are and what they aren't and what the limits are. You know, as a mom myself, I just assume a lot of my rights as a parent and I expect the government to stay out of it. But there are sort of legal parameters. And so could you just give us a little background on what that looks like?
Sure. And I think that's kind of why we had such an issue during COVID, because a lot of Americans just assumed that the government knew their place in our lives and would respect the role of parents. Certainly our founding fathers in creating the founding documents of America, there was no question as to whether or not the government or parents should know best for their children and who should be making decisions. But during COVID, what we saw was a government and a nation that seemed to overreach into the home. And since then, I call it COVID lemonade because we kind of all woke up. Parents across the country said, wait a second, why are there doctors or lawyers or elected officials or bureaucrats trying to tell me how to raise my children, whether or not to vaccinate them, whether or not to mask them? And then certainly, you know, what names or pronouns I should be using for my child. And we can talk a little bit about that today. But, you know, a nation woke up to parental rights and parents under attack. So when I talk about parents, parents have the fundamental right to direct the upbringing of their children. This is not a right that the government grants you. It's certainly not a right they can take away easily, right? We ask the court to apply something called strict scrutiny when looking at any issue of parental rights. It's the highest burden on the court that says the government must show that there's a reason why your parental rights should be taken away. The burden is not on the parent to prove that you have those rights. And so parents have the right to direct their kids' education, their religion, their morality, their medical care. And we can just see from the attack on parents and on really our freedom and liberty in general across the country that all of those areas are being questioned by the left. And it leaves us in this moment where we need to stand up and fight to protect our children.
You said something interesting, maybe, Ari, you have some legal perspective on this, too. But what you basically what I heard you say is that it's assumed that parents have rights regarding their children. And the state can only intervene if it's demonstrated that those rights have been violated in some way, but or there's abuse or something like that. But the foundation is the assumption of parental rights.
Yeah, absolutely. And but we see there, you know, in cases, all of America has been following what's been happening in Colorado, where they want to consider it to be abuse, redefining abuse, if you're not willing to affirm your child's want of changing their gender. And so, you know, parental rights, again, under attack in America. And there was just this moment during COVID when I was sitting on a school board and in Florida, and the superintendent was going to create a medical committee, he said, and he was going to bring in the head of the hospital, the head of the health department, and a few doctors of his choosing that were going to make recommendations to the school board. Now, if you're an elected official, you are tasked with making decisions. And when you have a committee of experts, and you know, we know the expert class is really failed Americans overall. But when you have a team of experts that are going to give you recommendations, it's very difficult as an elected official to not take those recommendations because, of course, doctors are going to know better than you. But during COVID, we saw, in fact, that, you know, there were many doctors who really didn't know better than parents for their kids. And so I looked at this superintendent and I said, sir, I don't think you understand. Even when I take my child to the doctor, to the pediatrician, that's a recommendation that that pediatrician makes. I'm not required to follow what that doctor says. And I looked at him and I said, we do not co-parent with the government. And that became a rallying cry, I think, for a lot of parents across the country. They really felt that in their soul. And then we started Moms for Liberty and put that on T-shirts. And I think we sold something like $150,000 worth of T-shirts in the first year of parents across the United States just saying, government, you need to know your place in our lives.
I mean, it's a really good point that in a lot of cases, the real question is, where does the burden lie, especially in the law, right? And so your position is that the burden always lies with the government in these kind of highly sensitive in areas that affect kind of the internal dynamics of a family. And so is your position that parental rights are fundamentally a constitutional issue, that it's an issue of law and statute, or it's a kind of even deeper kind of social or kind of like human rights issue? So when you say parental rights, like, what context are you speaking in?
That you're granted these rights by God. That the government doesn't give you the right to raise and direct your children. You know, not only do we have a right to direct our children, but we have a duty. We have a responsibility to raise our children. If you're a believer in God, God commands parents to raise up their children. And so the government, the idea that the government would somehow interfere in between the relationship of the parent and the child, this natural right that we have, is absolutely ridiculous.
Would you say that parents have a right to review, let's say, a school's curriculum? I'm just trying to sort out, where does this right kind of start and end? Is it a veto right? Is it a right of first review? Or is it?
Yeah, that's a great question.
That's a great question that was just posed to the Supreme Court, right? Mahmoud v. Taylor, a case in Montgomery County where parents wanted to opt out of certain curriculum that was in the schools. Now, parents have the fundamental right to direct the education of their kids. To me, that means they get to decide where they go to school. And right now we have compelled compulsory school. Kids have to go to school. You have to report that your children go to school. In some places, they're trying to attack homeschooling. In Illinois, there was a real attack on homeschool. Homeschool wasn't always legal. I think we have to remember that. In New York City, for example, I know that the yeshivas were under attack by the New York City public school system. I believe that parents should be able to choose where to send their kids to school. So I fundamentally believe in school choice. I believe in the principle of educational freedom, that parents should be the ones directing their children's education. Now, there are certain laws that are in place in the United States, something called the Pupil Protection Rights Amendment, that says that there must be transparency when it comes to curriculum and what children are being taught in school. It also says that children can't be surveyed about things like political affiliation, sexual orientation from parents or the children. But that law is being broken right now, and we're going to go through a process, hopefully with the support of the president, to be able to do revisions in Congress, to do revisions to the Pupil Protection Rights Amendment, to put some teeth in it so that parents have, let's say, maybe a private right of action. So when their rights are violated there, that they'll be able to actually hold schools accountable. But it is absolutely my position that if there's something that's being taught in the classroom, and the parents are uncomfortable with it in some manner, that there needs to be a mechanism for them to challenge that material, and then just certainly to remove their child if they don't feel comfortable with that information being taught.
I think the transparency issue is a really key one also. I think a lot of us as parents feel that there's one level of what Ari's suggesting, where the line is between parental rights and obligations to the state and where the state can intervene. But there's also this idea of just knowing what the state can and cannot do and is or is not allowed to do. And many of us simply don't know the answers to those questions. COVID, that was a famous, instance where a lot of us thought, do you have the right? Are you being mandated by the health department to tell my kids that they must wear a mask on the playground? Or is that just your preference? What rights do I have as a parent to even question it and fight it? And it came up for me personally with my child's pediatrician a few years ago, who in a private meeting when they were underage, they were young teenagers, and they're, I think, 13 or 14, and they were asked privately if they were comfortable with their gender and, you know, all those things. Without my knowledge, she didn't tell me she was going to have that conversation. And afterwards, she fought me when I complained about it, calling herself my children's safe space, to which I replied, they don't know your first name. You know, I'm their safe space. But I didn't even know. I asked her, were you mandated to ask my children those questions, or did you just choose to? And she actually admitted that she just chose to. But knowing whether or not it's mandated by the state is even a problem. So what can you tell us about just that transparency and the level of information that parents have so that they can then adjust and fight where necessary?
My first message to parents is, and I hear from parents all the time, that they're being asked to step out of the room if their child is over 12, or there's, you know, that there are states where age 12 is the age of informed consent, that the child has to give permission for the parent to have access to the medical information. I think just solidifying with your child in a really honest way that you are in charge of their health and well-being, and you will be helping to chart that course is very important. And of course, I think you set that tone in your household from a very early age. If a doctor tells you to step out of the exam room, parents say no. They absolutely do not have the right to do that. And if they insist that I would personally take my child out of that doctor's office. But I think you're right. Parents weren't sure, right? What can the government can or can't tell me to do? Now, I'll be honest with you. I think it was pretty visceral. I had a pretty visceral reaction to COVID. I remember March 13th, 2020, they said they were going to shut down schools. I felt like someone punched me in the stomach. And I just knew in my core that this was wrong, that the government didn't have the right to do this. And I thought masks, like I was pretty adamant about the fact that I wasn't going to mask my children and that I wasn't going to wear a mask. Now, luckily, I lived in Florida, and Florida helped to lead the rest of the country, I think, out of the COVID madness, certainly when it came to schools. But, you know, Rebecca, you're right. I would talk to parents in Washington or Oregon, and they weren't sure what right they had to say no. And I really believe that if parents had stood in the truth of knowing that these are their children, that there are other people cannot tell them what to do as far as raising their children and providing education or medical care, COVID wouldn't have happened in the way that it did. I think if parents had said in mass, we're not going to mask our kids, the schools wouldn't actually have been able to force it. Certainly, we saw during COVID when places like California or New York tried to mandate the COVID vaccine for students, that when parents stood up and said no, the schools backed down. Los Angeles, LAUSD kept putting off the COVID vaccination requirement. And then in New York, we had moms en masse coming out. They actually took their children's shoes and put them on the steps of the schools or tied them to fences. I have pictures. I was just looking at them the other day. Hundreds and hundreds of shoes to show how many kids were actually going to be exiting the school system if the COVID vaccination had been required. And so parents saying no and stepping up did stop a lot of this. And I'm very hopeful, and I'm working to the end of removing the COVID vaccine for children off the vaccine schedule, because there's absolutely no evidence to show that is good for them. In fact, we have a lot of evidence to show that it is, in fact, not necessary and not in their best interest. So really, it's parents standing together and knowing that they are the primary, they have the duty and the responsibility and the right to raise their kids.
I'm curious about sort of, you know, how you think about expertise. Like, I think lots of Americans have a ton of skepticism towards the so-called experts for all the reasons you articulated, Tiffany. But for example, like when you just said about removing the COVID vaccine, the argument seems to be, well, because the evidence shows that it's not effective or not effective as it's claimed, right? So there is a kind of reliance on like data or expertise, or that like masking actually didn't work. That's the reason actually why you fundamentally you're against it. It's because this is what the data shows. So I guess I'm curious on this, you know, parental rights issue. What about vaccines, let's say, other than the COVID one, vaccines where there is a stronger basis for working or not working? I mean, would you support that, you know, some of those vaccines being mandated in schools? It's just another way of asking about the limits of parental rights. I'm interested in anything where, you know, where how far can we go, and how do we know where that line is?
Yeah, I think in general, the entire vaccine schedule for children needs to be revisited. And I think that we need to ask a lot of questions about it. And I think that when it comes to the health and safety of our children, that we should be asking all the questions. And if there's anyone that's trying to silence you or stop you from asking questions, the next question you need to be asking is why? Because parents deserve accurate information so they can make informed decisions for their children. There is evidence to show that a lot of the vaccines may not actually be working in the way that they should, and that the harms may outweigh the actual risk to the child. Certainly with COVID, when you speak about COVID, children were not affected. Thank God. We're not affected like other populations were during COVID. The children that were affected had, you know, various comorbidities. And even then, the number was very small. I was a big proponent of the Great Barrington Declaration, which was focused protection for those who are most vulnerable. Anytime parents are asking questions about how to make decisions for their children, if we're silencing parents, if we're telling them don't ask those questions, or somehow we're not being open and honest and giving the information that they're asking for, then we're not working in service of children. Because again, parents deserve that accurate information. So I think what you're going to see, and I pray that we're going to see Bobby Kennedy and the MAHA movement really pushing to have that vaccine schedule reviewed. And if the evidence shows that the vaccine is in fact effective and working and that the children are at risk and they need to continue to take the vaccinations, well, then, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do that. But if there's evidence to show that perhaps there are adverse harms to children, then we need to be honest about those harms and we need to address them because our kids deserve that.
I want to ask you about the coalition. Really, that I think overlaps between the work you're doing on parental rights, the work you did at Moms for Liberty, and the MAHA movement, which we've been talking about a lot today. There's a lot of crossover in terms of the people who are animated by these issues. And I was at one of your Moms for Liberty conferences a couple of years ago. I spoke there, and I was struck by, how normal 800 people in a room could be. But, you know, there was a thread through. There were a lot of people of faith, all kinds of faiths. There were a lot of people who were sort of, MAHA wasn't born yet, but it was that they might have been the seeds of the MAHA movement. Those are people who were certainly had inclinations in that direction. And so I wonder now in the parental rights movement, such that it is, if we're calling that a thing and you're leading it, who are the sort of people who are the constituency that you're serving and that you're trying to talk to and grow? And then I think at the same time, you know, what's the constituency look like on the other side of it? Where are you finding the most resistance? I know in school board meetings, it's unions. And can you just outline the constituencies here and in your work?
And just to jump on that, it's a great question. But as sort of COVID recedes, right, and as you have younger parents maybe who come up whose kids weren't in school during COVID, I mean, how are you seeing this coalition evolve and move forward?
Thought too, yeah.
That's great. So those are really great questions. I'll try to go through them one by one. Rebecca, I look back at that event in Philadelphia, right? We had a number of presidential candidates that spoke there at that event. President Trump then spoke, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, Asa Hutchinson, even Vivek Ramaswamy. And one of the reporters who was there said to me, you know, it was very interesting because the candidates were a lot more interested in your moms than the moms were in the candidates. And I thought that was an interesting reflection. What I really have seen across the parental rights movement and then the MAHA movement is that people that were really just not that political. They woke up, COVID or some other issue affected them in some way, and they realized that we had a government that wasn't working in service of the people, and that because we weren't involved, because we were just living our lives like ordinary people, busy, right, raising our kids, having businesses, working, we weren't considering running for office, serving in office, being involved in campaigns as something that was a part of our lives. And because of that, I think a political class rose up that, you know, somebody, I always thought about politicians like, oh, that's like someone's job and I'm just not that, right? Not that I could be a mom and be in politics, or I would could be a working professional and be in politics. And I think you have a group of people who realized that their voices were not being heard and that there were other people making decisions on behalf of their families that were hurting their kids. So I really think it's a true political realignment in America. You know, I do believe that President Trump was taken over the finish line by Bobby Kennedy joining him. I do believe that. I think that it made the coalition very strong. It brought a lot of new people to the movement. And my hope is that we're going to keep them with us, right? Even as we go through some interesting times as Americans. You've seen the tariffs with President Trump, and there's been, a warning of perhaps price increases and things. And I think parents are the stakeholders of the future. And if there's short-term pain for long-term gain, parents are going to be willing to do that because we know that the position that America was in was dangerous with, you know, so many children, 2/3 of children not reading on grade level in America's classrooms, and a nation that was reliant on China for so much of what happens in our country. And I think, you know, for parents, that's very concerning. We want a bright future for our kids. So that's kind of...
Did you like President Trump's comments that, well, maybe you won't get 30 Barbies this year, you'll get two? I mean, did that feel like someone who was kind of in touch with, you know, I mean, I just to say that, you know, Christmas isn't that far away, and it's possible that a lot of parents are going to have a harder time buying Christmas presents for their kids. So I'm curious about the economic dimension of this as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that President, you know, if I'm betting on somebody to turn America around, it's going to be President Trump. He's done it before. I believe he can do it again. And so, you know, my money's on him to help to realign the American economy in a way that will be productive for our kids in the future and set America up on a path to success. I think there are many Americans that probably... Or we're just kind of waking up to the fact that the deficit and everything that was happening in our country had put us in a very weak position, the lack of industrialization that we were seeing. So, you know, was I okay with that comment? I think we saw, American parents saw during COVID that, you know, there was a lot of money being flushed into government schools, that we know there was this DoorDash industry, right, where the people that could stay home and get, you know, deliveries to their house. Well, that was very nice for them. But a lot of our moms were essential workers. They were nurses or they were teachers. They were trying to balance their lives and their kids. And so I don't think overall the American parents were that upset to hear that. I think what they think is that, you know, we need to get America on the right track. We've been on the wrong track. We gave President a mandate to turn the country around, and we're here for the long haul.
Tiffany, I want to talk really very now specifically about the things you're working on at Heritage, the individual issues and projects. And I, you know, I want to start with the case that's currently happening in Colorado, where the Colorado State Senate passed a bill. I forget the name of the Loving bill, Kelly Loving, that has to do with the stated goal is to provide more protections for transgender people. But it's really been at the center of this parental rights issue discussion. And so would you talk a little bit about that case, let our audience know what's happening there and why that's a parental rights issue?
Sure. I call it the anti-parent bill. And it went through a number of different amendments, but I think it's important for all of America to see what the left is willing to do as far as parental rights is concerned, which is to really take away the right of the parent to direct the upbringing of the child. We'll see if the governor signs it. All indications say that he is going to. But, you know, what it said basically was that, you know, if you're not willing to affirm your child's want of changing their gender, that you could lose custody of your child. If there was a custody dispute between parents, that the parent that was willing to affirm would be the one who would be able to raise their child. It said a number of other things as well. It's interesting to note that there was a similar bill that had been passed through the House and Senate in California, and Governor Newsom vetoed that bill. And I think that's a sign to show that a gentleman like Gavin, who wants to run for president, and I think we're all very clear about that, knows that politically it's a bill that will hurt him in the long run, because the majority of Americans do not believe that gender ideology is something that we should be teaching our children or inserting into their lives. I will tell you, there is no such thing as a transgender child. There's no such thing as a transgender person. There are men.
Do you believe that the governor of Colorado, if it gets there, will veto this bill?
No, I think he may sign it. I just saw a picture of his mother, who is a trans activist. She has dyed pink, blue, and white hair. So I do think he may sign it.
And what other projects in that space are you working on at Heritage?
So it was really issue to engage it was really important to engage on the issue of gender ideology, because it was perverting this idea of parental rights. Parents were, you know, transitioning their kids. You have every major medical institution willing to support this idea of gender affirming care, putting a child on puberty blockers, cross sex hormones, perhaps medical transition. And you have the right to raise your kids, but you don't have the right to abuse your children. If your child wanted to be a pirate and you took them into the doctor's office and you said, "My son wants to be a pirate. Can you cut off his leg and poke out his eye and put an eye patch on and a peg leg, you wouldn't be able to do that. The doctor wouldn't do that. They would be arrested if they did. You would be arrested for child abuse. But somehow in this instance, stopping the natural healthy development of a child was considered okay. It's not. It's child abuse. And so it's important to engage on the issue of gender ideology and to say, yes, parents, you have the right to raise your children. You do not have the right to abuse your children. And let's be very clear that gender-affirming care is child abuse. So that's been a really important issue. I've worked at the Heritage Foundation with a friend of mine, Jay Richards, building a coalition across the country of not just Republicans, but Republicans and Democrats, independents. It's a very broad-based issue, as I said before. We'll be working on really a reckoning of what happened during COVID, looking at the health and well-being of children and the role that parents should be playing, the transparency that they should have. We'll be talking about education in a series of called What's Best for Kids. We'll be talking about technology. How should our children be interacting with technology? What type of access should they have to it at school? How should it be used? And so there are a lot of different issues that are happening that are affecting children across the country. And what we want to try to do at the Heritage Foundation through this parental rights initiative is make sure that parents' voices are being heard. And in a time, you know, you talked about the expert class failing, at a time when Americans really don't know what to think about things or who to trust, I'd love for the Heritage Foundation to be a place where parents can go to say, where does the Heritage Foundation stand on this issue? They listen to our questions. They're giving us feedback. They're letting us have a voice. And where are their policy experts landing? So that's my hope.
I'm really interested in this technology in schools question, because I think it goes to the issue of, you know, can a school make any rule? Because, of course, some parents are going to disagree, right? So let's say a school decides banning cell phones, right? We've looked at some of the data. We think it's bad for our students. We've talked to our teachers. They don't want kids on laptops or phones. And a coalition of parents in the school says, I want my kid to have a phone during the day for any kinds of reasons. I mean, where do you come out in that situation?
It's just happening at my kid's school right now.
Yeah.
I just got that email about phones.
Yeah. How would you think that through?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because private schools and public schools are going to be handled differently, right? The governance model is different. This is why I'm such a big proponent of school choice and for parents to be able to choose where they send their children to school. So if there's a rule that is made at the school that they don't like and don't want to be a part of, then they can remove their child if they see feet. I mean, Ketanji Brown Jackson in the Mahmood case made the point where she said, you know, if parents don't like it, they should just take their kids out of the school. Well, that was an advertisement.
Yeah, but that's not really a solution in every case. I mean, I think she was rightfully ridiculed for saying that. I mean, right? From some folks on the right. I mean,
it's not currently right now, but only because in many blue states, the choice isn't there. You have, you know, helping children on thousands and thousands of students on waiting lists, even for charter schools, for choice within the public school system. And you have a cap on charter schools in New York. So parents are demanding choice. I think the ultimate way that you help parents to have schools that align with their values and what they want for their kids is to give them choice. So that's the guiding light here. If you don't like the rules that are being made at your kid's school, then you have to get involved. You know, in New York, you have community education councils. I say to parents, if you don't like the rules that are being made, get involved, run for the council, and have your voice heard. There are decisions that are going to be made at the local level. President Trump talks about abolishing the Department of Education. Why is that important? Because education shouldn't be run from Washington, D.C. There's a role for the government to play in protecting your civil rights, things like Title IX, for example. But the First Amendment and free speech, there's a role for the government to play. But ultimately, a lot of the decisions, like should phones be in schools? How should your children be interacting with technology? Those are decisions that should be made at the local level where parents can have their voice heard. And you're not going to like every decision that's being made. And again, it's just another argument for schools.
Yeah. You know why that's such a frustrating conversation for parents? Because the very last thing in life I would like to do is join some board at my children's school and spend what little free time I have fighting with ideologues who have an agenda. It's just another pressure on parents that we don't want. But you're right. I mean, that might be the only way to solve it. But I wanted to ask about that, you know, the nature of the forces coming at parents, to try to get to the heart of what that is. I remember just briefly, I was at something with attorney Bobby Ann Cox a couple of years ago where she was talking about the Connecticut schools. We were in Connecticut at the time. And And not only that, you know, school counselors and psychologists had the right to speak to your minor children about everything from drug abuse to abortions to, you know, gender affirming care, such as it's called, but without your knowledge. But they figured out that parents were finding out after the fact by way of insurance bills, sometimes coming to the parents' address. And they actually legislated in the state of Connecticut to make it okay for the clinics and the hospitals to send the bill to a third address so that the parents wouldn't see it. So the deliberate nature of this, the determination to separate children from parents is really what interests me. This isn't just, you know, I don't know, a fad. This is a thing that is being directed. And could you just comment on what is that? Who is that?
I believe it's communism. I believe it's a want for everyone to be reliant on the government and the structure of family. The foundation of family is something that, you know, keeps communism away. If you are not, if you're reliant on the government for everything, then, you know, then the government controls you. And so ultimately, you know, we talk about the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. I think the anti-Semitism we see, the gender ideology, all of it that we see, the woke indoctrination in general is just a part of this revolution that's been happening. And when we were back to Philadelphia, we had protests all over the streets. Yes. It was wild. It was protesting us, and it was the young communists and the democratic socialists that were protesting us. And so it's really a war on Western civilization.
And interestingly, there were a lot of transgender activists out there, I noted too. Yeah.
Sure.
And you know, what's the transgender issue is something that really, you know, you have LGBTQ, LGB is sexual orientation, love who you want to love, T is mental distress, and then the Q is queer theory. And queer theory is a political ideology that has no limiting principle. That's why that flag constantly evolves. And you have, you know, now minor attracted people instead of pedophiles, right? Where does it stop? Well, the point of queer theory is that it doesn't, that it continues to tear down norms and traditions. And that's why you see this injection of the government and this wedge being drawn between the parent and the child, because they don't want us to pass on our values and our traditions. They want the children to think in a different way. And, you know, you can look no farther than Hitler and other horrible tyrannical leaders across the history to see how they drove a wedge between the parent and the child. And they really tried to indoctrinate the children so that they could, you know, continue their control.
Yeah, you know, both in the Sun and on this program, we've been covering the sort of higher education crisis, and really believe it's an important story. I wonder if parents of college age kids, maybe like the one sitting next to me soon, will take a page from your playbook. I mean, the legal issues, of course, is different if someone is 18, and you know, but you know, parents paying thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and sending their kids to, you know, universities, and you have the most radical kinds of ideology and behavior and all that. It's not exactly in your wheelhouse, but I wonder if, you know, there are lessons or there's sort of guidance that you might be called upon to offer to parents of kids who are a little older, but still young and still exposed.
Right. Can I just say, just firstly, and then yeah. I want to hear your recommendations. But after that incident with our pediatrician, yeah. My kids were young. I looked at them and I said, I prepped them. I said, the next time anybody asks you what gender you are, you say, I don't participate in that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. You don't have some big blowout fight. This isn't a thing. It's like saying, you know, do you love your parents? You don't debate that. Mm-hmm. You're a boy or you're a girl. That's how I've raised you. That's the truth. And so we're not even going to engage it. So I imagine when they land on college campus and someone says, please call me Z, Zay, and right. They, right. They're just going to say, thank you, but I don't participate in that. But what would you tell your children or other children to?
You're right. I think the first thing that you need to do is inoculate your kids in the manner that you did. And, you know, I think your point for a teacher or someone else to tell a child that their parents might be wrong about something so basic as whether they're a boy or a girl is destabilizing. It's emotional abuse.
Well, their pediatrician of all people too. She should know better.
Of all people, that's exactly right. But you know, I have 4 kids, 13, 15, 17, and 20. I think parents, I've talked to a lot of parents who are sending their kids off to college. Parents have been having their children make different choices. I think, you know, there are legacy, you know, families that have gone to Ivy Leagues and that are making the choice to not send their children there anymore. They're not giving to the schools that they've been giving to in the past. And I think it's sad for many of them. But I think, you know, but I know that parents are, you know, putting their children first. And so I think you're seeing a lot of kids go to different schools that perhaps they didn't think they were going to go to, or rethinking college in general. I think COVID gave us permission to kind of rethink all of the things that we thought we had to do, right? All of a sudden, we took kindergartners, we didn't send them to school for 2 years. And then we said, oh, you're in second grade now. You know, I mean, the whole idea of education, I think, has changed. And we need to not just be stuck on the schedule of you're this age and this is what you should be doing. We need to be, you know, more individualized in how we're treating the kids and what's best for them. But, you know, for parents, I just say, you know, I mean, if my kid was out protesting somewhere, they wouldn't be out at that school anymore. I wouldn't be paying for it. And as far as the federal funding for the schools, whether it's Harvard or a public school, you know, you can choose to go to school. A school can teach. You can choose to teach something, but doesn't mean that federal funding has to go to teaching that. And so this idea that federal funding is, you know, should be going to these schools and that they can teach whatever they want using the federal money is just ridiculous. I think that the government, if they're giving money, should expect academic excellence, and so should parents.
Tiffany, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Today. I hope everyone will go to the Heritage website and find out more about your work. And we hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, we're launching just on the Heritage. Look for a landing page that's going to be up soon for our Parental Rights Network. So if you're someone that's a leader, if you just want to stay in the know about the court cases that are happening and events that are happening that are important, different challenges and states that are happening that might help you to inform yourself to be a more effective advocate, you can join that Parental Rights Network. I'll be meeting every week. So keep your eye out for that.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tiffany. Take care. Bye.